Right, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for organizing this nice meeting. You've probably seen this slide many times. There's lots and lots of different theories of dark matter. Of course, there's a new dark matter candidate called the Brexiton, which goes out of thermal equilibrium and then acts as a decoupled spectator while it decays. I'm not talking about the Brexiton today, though. Let's talk about more normal dark matter candidates. Of course, we've got a problem when we start looking for dark matter because our normal WIMP candidates, our detectors, are becoming so sensitive, they're about to start to detect neutrinos. Atmospheric neutrinos, supernova neutrinos, and solar neutrinos. Those neutrinos will lead to... I've got a hockey stick, haven't I? A weird hockey stick for not the grass. Okay, so coherent neutrino-nucleon interaction will lead to scattering of these neutrinos. That will mean that if the cross section for dark matter is too low, we won't be able to see the dark matter because of all the neutrinos. Of course, this in itself is interesting because it's not been observed in the standard model yet. Okay, so if we expect to observe this, and we've predicted that it should be coherent according to our theories, but it'll be nice to see it. And of course, the classic example is the similarity of a 6 GeV WIMP to the boron 8 background. They're virtually indistinguishable from each other for a particular cross section. So this is a very clear signal that it's going to be very difficult to disentangle neutrinos from the sun and low mass dark matter. So we've done various things in this area to try and figure out whether we can tell between the dark matter and the neutrinos, and also whether we can use the observation of the neutrinos to tell us new things about physics. Okay, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So for example, if you wanted to tell the difference between the dark matter and the neutrinos, it might help if you had a directional dark matter detector. For example, here's a prototype directional dark matter detector, DMTPC. Now, this is a very small target mass, and you'd face major technological challenges to scale up. But let's just carry on regardless, in the spirit of theorists, and see whether you can detect the difference between the dark matter signals and the neutrino signals. And of course, you can, because the neutrino signals for these low-mass dark matter are coming from the sun. Okay? And you know where the sun is. And so what you can do is you can look at the angle between the recoil in one of these experiments and the direction of the sun. And of course, the recoil comes from the opposite direction to where the sun is, okay? As you would expect. But of course, for the dark matter, the recoil is coming from a different direction. In particular, it's coming from the direction of the constellation of Cygnus, because that's roughly where we're traveling as we move around the galaxy. And of course, there's an annual modulation as the Earth goes around the sun. But you can look at these things and you can crunch the numbers and you can tell, you could take into account some sort of semi-realistic projected errors for these kind of experiments, should they ever be big enough to detect this signal. And you can prove to yourself that for this problematic case where you've got a 6 GeV WIMP, if you don't have directional discrimination, it's very, very difficult to tell the difference. This is some statistical test, and we need to separate the blue and the red histograms. Okay? But if you do include directionality, you can very, very clearly see a difference between a neutrino signal and a dark matter signal. Okay.
But just to be clear, you're talking about dark matter nuclear recoils and solar neutrino electrons.
No, I'm talking about solar neutrino nuclear recoils here.
But the solar neutrino nuclear recoils coherent at the high mass WIMPs are from the DSMB and supernova, not from the sun. So they don't necessarily...
So those guys this wouldn't work for. This would only work because the diffuse supernova neutrinos the atmospheric neutrinos are not coming from the direction of the sun. There are other things that you could do if you had enough statistics. You could try and figure out how the atmosphere was breathing with regards to time, but it's very, very much more complicated. Okay. One of the things we thought about in our group, another way to get around this, was the idea of polarized targets. Okay. So, again, I want you to be very clear. We're very, very far away from the experimental. We've decided to place ourselves quite far away from realistic experiments and just say, let's assume that we have any experiment that we can imagine. What could we do with it? So I apologize to those of you in the audience who are at the hardcore front who actually have to build stuff. This stuff's not easy to build. But let's just allow ourselves to have a bit of imagination for a while. Let's imagine we build some polarized targets. They're actually not very good. The reason why I started looking at polarized targets is because some experimental colleagues said, well, we reckon we can polarize xenon. What could we do with that? Would it help us look for dark matter? And very quickly I realized that it wouldn't really help you looking for most models of dark matter. You could probably think about whether it could help constrain some crazy model of dark matter, but generally it's not a lot of use. But it might help you when it comes to neutrinos, because neutrinos will be sensitive if you can polarize all the nuclear spins in a target. But then again, xenon's not a good example, because what happens with xenon is if you do have this polarization effect to detect neutrinos, the neutrinos, that'll be a spin-dependent interaction, but the neutrinos will also scatter coherently. And that'll be a lot bigger for something like xenon, because xenon's got about 100 neutrons in it. So consequently, the coherent cross-section always washes out this spin-dependent cross-section, which depends on the orientation of the spin. So that's not true for something like helium-3, which has got very, very, very much fewer neutrons in, okay? So if you did have a helium-3 detector, and you polarized your helium-3 detector, and let me be clear, it's quite easy to polarize helium-3. This is something which is done in hospitals for nuclear magnetic resonance imaging all the time. And I spoke to a medical physicist at the University of Sheffield, who's nothing to do with the dark matter guys at the University of Sheffield and had never heard of them. He said, yeah, I can get it up to 90%. Well, I said, well, could you get it up to 99%? He said, well, I could have tried, yeah, I've never tried, but I don't see why not. And so, in principle, you can polarize these things. So, and then if you do polarize it, then the cross-section depends on the orientation of the neutrino coming in relative to the spin. So what you can do is, while for xenon, if we say we polarize our detector and then we point it at the sun and then we point it away from the sun, the cross-section really doesn't change very much, because the effect is, the small effect due to the polarization is dwarfed by the coherent cross-section. But for helium-3, you can almost completely switch off the neutrino interactions. So if you built a dark matter detector out of helium-3 and polarized it, you could switch off the solar neutrinos. Which problem?
The coherent interactions.
Yes, it would still have that problem.
So you have to go down.
You have to go down. So here's, this is, thank you for the very good question. So here's a figure of merit for how big this effect is, right? And you see for helium, it's helium-3, it's 97%. But if we choose some other things, it gets worse and worse. But still, you've got a 41% effect for carbon-13, for example. Does that address your question? Problems, obvious problems, you know, the most obvious problem is helium-3 makes xenon look about as cheap as water, okay? Especially since 9/11, because people are using it at borders because it detects radioactive materials, because it loves a neutron. Helium-3 loves a neutron. Right. So we've been thinking about that, we're still thinking about that, and possible extensions of that idea. More practical, potentially. We expect to detect neutrinos. What could we do with this information? Okay, so here are some experiments. What have we got here? We've got, this is a generation 2 germanium, so this is our theorist analog of super CDMS. This is generation 2 xenon, so this is our theorist analog of Lux Zeppelin. And here's the future xenon, future argon, and some crazy future neon. So this is sort of Darwin. This is maybe dark side or some equivalent. And depending on the thresholds, they will detect large numbers of boron-8 neutrinos through nuclear recoils and large number of pp neutrinos from electron recoils. Pp neutrinos have got less energy than the boron-8 neutrinos, but if they hit an electron, they give rise to a recoil energy that's in the same range as that KeV range that these dark matter detectors are designed to detect. And we might see, for these future detectors, depending on the threshold, we could see between 500 and 10,000. It depends very, very sensitively upon how low these guys can get their threshold. Because as they lower their threshold, they start to see more and more of these boron-8 neutrinos. Well, we could do various things. We can measure the boron-8 flux. Other people have measured it, but we could measure it. We could measure the PP flux for electron recoils. We could measure the Weinberg angle at very low energies. These are the accuracies that we could measure the Weinberg angle at. Now that might, it's not particularly interesting, but it's something that you could do. Now, you could also do some beyond the standard model physics. Well, you could do some solar physics. But the trouble is that we're not detecting the CNO neutrinos. So while we can do some solar physics, ultimately we're just increasing our knowledge of the proton-proton chain, because both the boron 8, when we're talking about nuclear recoils, and the PP neutrinos when we're talking about electron recoils, they're both from the same PP chain, okay? They're not from the CNO train. There is this problem that we don't really understand what's going on with the sun. When we look at the elemental abundance on the surface of the sun, and when we look at the helioseismology, which probes the interior density of the sun, they don't seem to add up to each other, so we'd like to understand what's going on better. And to do that, we really want to get a handle on the CNO neutrinos, and they're very elusive. But nevertheless, we can improve our knowledge of it when we look at the plane of uncertainty in the opacity of the sun and uncertainty in the metallicity of the sun. We can go from the current situation, which is the dotted ellipses, down to these solid-colored ellipses. We can also test beyond the standard model physics. The momentum exchanged when you get PP neutrino electron events is about 10 keV. And the momentum exchanged for neutrino nucleon events is about the MeV scale. Both of these Q squareds are not the same Q squareds that are probed by other neutrino experiments. So if there are bosons, new bosons, which give rise to new interactions between neutrinos and quarks or neutrinos and leptons, then we might be able to probe them if they're in that region. And we did this, we did some work on this. The previous work that I did, I should say, was with some students who've now left, and also Tarso Franarin, who's my current student. This work I did with, Celine was on this paper, Celine Bowen, but also David Sedeno, Aaron Vincent, Thomas Jobb, and Pedro Machado. Yeah. We're just looking at the event rate. So the event rate that we would get in a direct detection experiment from from solar neutrinos would change if there were new interactions. That's all we're looking at. And here's how it would change for various different assumptions. So what we've got here is the exchange of a scalar. So here's the kind of thing that we're probing. We're probing interactions between neutrinos and quarks and neutrinos and leptons. This is for electron recoils. This is a scalar. These are different masses between 1 keV and 100 keV. And this is for nuclear recoils. And this is the number of events we would get per ton year for different targets, germanium, silicon, xenon, argon, neon, and for different boson masses, 1 keV, with a particular choice, a very, very small coupling here, okay, would lead to differences. So we can probe this. Now, instead, if you look at the set, very, very similar calculation, but using vectors and making a relationship between the coupling to quarks and the coupling to leptons in the context of a U1 B minus L model, you can see how these constraints from direct detection experiments compare to the constraints we get from other experiments. So the dotted lines are the nuclear recoils, and the dashed lines are the electron recoils in this situation. And the different colors correspond to, the green is a future xenon experiment like Darwin, the blue is LZ, a theorist analog, and the red is super CDMS, a theorist analog. And you can see that for quite a lot of this parameter space, you can get constraints from these experiments. Some places, admittedly, it's not completely orders of magnitude better than everything else, but in some regions, where there are no other constraints, and in other regions where there are only astrophysical constraints. So it's nice to do so. No, the BB. I thought the BBN constraints are on here. All right. I'll double check that and I'll get back to you. You're telling me that I've ruled out this entire. Some of this region is ruled out.
But a significant chunk, like in the middle, there is a white spot that should be there, correct? There's more
This guy. Okay, let me check that later. It doesn't seem possible to measure. So far, we've been talking about these boron 8 neutrinos up here. It doesn't seem possible to measure the diffuse supernova neutrino background, even with an experiment like Darwin. That's because it's right down here, and it's also got, these guys have got low energy. So you've got the boron 8 neutrinos, then you've got these guys, and then over here you've got the atmospheric neutrinos. And Darwin can't really get down into this corner down here. We have done some work which has got nothing to do with dark matter detectors with Jonathan Davis, looking at whether we can measure the diffuse supernova neutrino using future experiments like Hyper-K. And we think we can. And we can use that to put a constraint on things like assuming various priors. We can put a constraint on the history of black hole production. And if you combine that with LIGO, you can, in fact, put constraints on how many of the black holes are appearing in binaries and what have you, what the merger rate is. But it seems very, very difficult to detect the diffuse supernova neutrino background, even with Darwin. Okay. But of course, as we've seen yesterday, we can observe a neutrino. If we have a supernova that goes off at about 10 kiloparsecs, it's very easy to detect it in a direct detection experiment. Okay. So this is for Darwin, and this is for something like LZ, and this is for xenon 1-ton. Now the question is, that we're looking at the moment, is can we do new fundamental physics with these observations? And will dark matter detectors help us make new, observe new fundamental physics? So one thing that you could do is you could use a supernova explosion to put constraints on scenarios of sterile neutrinos, okay? So as you move from the inside of the supernova to the outside of the supernova, as the neutrinos move out just after the supernova explosion, they go through different regions where there are resonances, obviously depending on the parameters that you're probing. And this changes the neutrino flux that you observe. Okay? So the situation that we've looked at the moment is a normal hierarchy, and we've looked at a sort of a 1 eV sterile neutrino with a mixing angle of about 10 degrees. And what we've done is we've looked at this. We've said, OK, let's say that we have a supernova that goes off at a distance of about 10 kiloparsecs. And we observe it with Hyper-K, but we also observe it with Darwin. Now, is there something that Darwin can give you that Hyper-K doesn't already give you on its own? And we think that there might be. Okay. The first thing to say is that there's quite a lot of nuisance parameters if you want to do fundamental physics with a supernova explosion. And that's the fact that we don't know precisely what the temperature of the neutrinos are in the supernova explosion. And we have some uncertainty as to the overall flux of the neutrinos in a supernova explosion. So we have to include these things, the temperature and the overall flux. But then we've also got constraints on the mass and the angle. Now, as you can see, the constraints on the mass are not very good. And the constraints on the angle are a bit better. This is showing Hyper-K doesn't really like no mixing angle here. This is a situation where we've taken a supernova explosion, and then we've put the neutrinos through the supernova explosion, assuming that there's some mixing on the way out. And we've done quite a lot of consistency checks to make sure that the mixing on the way out doesn't affect the supernova simulation that we used in the first place. But I can discuss that in slightly more detail if anybody's obsessed by it. And then you see that Darwin's even worse. So it will detect the supernova, but it'll get things wrong. If it gets this to be 1, then it's measuring things right. It's measuring the flux right. And if it gets this to be 1, it's measuring the temperature right. You can see it's systematically off. But that's OK. That's what happens. But here's an example of combining these things. So this is the actual sterile neutrino mass that we put into the simulation. And here's us trying to recover that sterile neutrino mass using observations using Hyper-K and using observations using Darwin. And you can see that they're both pretty useless on their own. But if you combine them together, because of course they detect neutrinos in different ways, you get much more information about the particular mass of the sterile neutrino that has led to mixing in the supernova explosion. So this is something that we've just got working, and we're now going to do it for different ranges of parameters and give it lots of kicks to make sure it's really doing what we think it's going to do, but hopefully should be on the archive in a few weeks or a couple of weeks. Depending on when people are going on holiday. So, and I should note that we haven't just multiplied these lines together. So this is like a projection of two sort of funny blobs in parameter space, which is, it's obvious that we haven't multiplied these two lines together. Just before I summarize, we're at King's College London. We're currently looking for strong fellowship candidates for five-year Royal Society and STFC fellowships, some of which are suitable, flexible working conditions. And in addition, there'll be one or two regular postdocs for advertisement towards the end of the year. Chris McCabe has joined us now through a five-year fellowship that we've managed to make permanent, and we've got Diego Blas coming in April. In summary, so please apply. In summary, dark matter detectors are about to detect neutrinos. It's very exciting. It'll lead to new tests of solar physics and beyond the standard model physics. And this new subject area will continue to grow in the next few years. Thanks for listening. My presence.
Do you have your sterile neutrino distribution?
Sorry?
Your sterile neutrino distribution? It's like a slide scripting. You say? Yeah.
This one.
So I interpret that as like you put in a sterile neutrino of mass, you know, 1.5 dB.
Yeah.
And the green basically is a projection of how well you can constrain that mass.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're motivated by, you know, the reactor anomalies and stuff like that. Is there any like other assumption that we went to, you know, half what, you know, the neutrino model, and it's just like one sterile neutrino you're putting in at one.
Yeah, we're putting in one sterile neutrino.
So it's like just a regular 40 neutrino scenario that has one extra angle, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's like marginalized over all these.
Yeah.
This distribution part.
So we've got a four-dimensional parameter space, and then we histogram it again. We've got this height cube, these four parameters we're varying. We then rebin it and take a profile of it. We combine these two height cubes and rebin them for four dimensions and then project it in order to get this. And it shows that, I mean, you would expect Darwin to give you more information because it's measuring the neutrinos in a fundamental So, and indeed it does. So we're currently trying to tie down what the extra power will be and in what situations will be most powerful. Because the reactor anomaly might not be particularly well motivated anymore, but nevertheless, it's something to say. Now, if you start looking at higher mass neutrinos, you get into problems because the mixing occurs deeper in the supernova, and if it's below the neutrino sphere, you don't really know what's going on. So you have to look at things like the chemical potential, the YE in the supernova. You have to make sure that this is not particularly sensitive to variations in that, which could be caused by this kind of mixing. And we've looked at those consistency checks. We haven't redone the supernova exponent, obviously.
Yeah. I just have a little bit about the serum model. So you need a three choices for which mixing angle of your diode.
They're all the same. Yeah.
It's just an extra, like a 1.4 angle, right? That's what you're putting in here, right? And the marginal angle for that.
No, I think we've got the same coupling to all three. Same mixing out to all three. We're going to do the. No, see, it could have been either.
Okay.
We're going to do. The inverted hierarchy we're running right now, and we're going to look at different situations. We're bashing with the stick to make sure it's really doing what we think it's doing. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sarah.